we were very happy to have gotten 69% of the vote, close to 70% in the primary. You know, this is a very diverse district, you know, 19 counties. And, you know, since the July 7th primary election is over, I've reached out to both my opponents, communicated with both of them, got a nice congratulations message from both of them. And now we're coming together to work hard on the September 10th election, and we'll continue to work hard.
Will that Tea Party enthusiasm for Mr. Flynn convert to ballots in the fall for you, or will it be them sitting on their hands?
Oh, I think I have strong support in the conservative part of the Republican Party and all aspects, really. So, you know, I'm confident in our ability to bring the party together. I already had a number of meetings with some of the people that did not support me and have gotten strong support from people that were with my opponents in the primary election. Nothing beats hard work, being active, being visible, talking about the issues, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
Upcoming in Congress is a big, big fight over the Iranian nuclear deal. How do you parse the pros and cons of that?
I have real concerns about the proposed deal. I don't know, you know, I think the 60-day clock is ticking now, so if I was fortunate enough to get elected on September 10th, I'm not sure I would have a say in it. But as I review the plan right now, I would oppose it. And I guess that's based on we're putting a lot of confidence and a lot of responsibility in a regime that has a very poor track record of being compliant, of following rules, of whether that's the United States sanctions and rules, whether that's the UN, whether that's the EU. You know, this track record of 15 to 20 years of basically snubbing their nose at any international body or any other country trying to tell them what to do. So now we have a framework put in place now that says that they are going to comply. And I'm very dubious and skeptical of trusting a regime that has not given us any reason to trust them.
The inspections portion, the verification portion that they are living up to the rest of the agreement, though, is among the strongest pieces of it. What part of that is weak, do you think?
What I have trouble with is I'm not sure there's going to be a blatant violation at first, but it's all the little things of you know, what happens if they don't let an inspector in, or what happens if they don't do this? I mean, there's a process that, you know, kind of goes up the food chain all the way up to the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I would feel much more comfortable if they had a record of being compliant and letting inspectors in and doing these different things. And as I understand it, too, they get a mass influx of money and resources when the sanctions get pulled off. I mean, it's a lot of upfront, you know, reward for a compliance record that hasn't been apparent there.
Do you have concerns about how they're going to use that economic relief or what?
I have concern that we're rewarding them up front without a track record of being compliant.
That's a chicken egg thing. How do you get that track record without allowing them to perform?
I guess I would look at, well, let's give it a couple years or 3 or 4 years. You know, let's see how they do in the first couple rounds of inspections. I guess I look at the example. We had a similar agreement that President Clinton negotiated with North Korea, you know, similar terms, and they basically violated every single protocol that was put in place after that. I think when you look at a regime like North Korea or Iran, you know, and then you hear the rhetoric coming out of the Grand Mullah over there that basically says, you know, the U.S. is still the Satan of the world, and they have all this rhetoric against the United States, it's just hard for me to conceptualize that they're going to be compliant. Now, to your broader point, I think, Charlie, you know, do I think economics and growing in prosperity can help move them away from kind of the radicalism? Possibly, but let's see that play out. I'm not sure that, again, going back to what I said, they haven't had a record of being compliant.
Well, we got to give them something now so they'll agree to the agreement. What is that something?
I think the something is, let's say, 5 years from now, here's what you're going to get, or 4 years from now, but we need you over the next 4 years to show us.
So they've got to live with crippling economic sanctions for another 4 to 5 years before they get anything?
Well, I think there's a more reasonable way to do that. I mean, I guess you don't reward somebody immediately for violating or not being compliant when you balance that out, from my view. And listen, I'm not in Congress. I'm not looking at this. But as I look at this and look at a regime, the perplexing thing for me is that we're rewarding a regime that is absolutely non-compliant, does not follow the rules. It's like a child, you know, continues to violate, you know, or misbehave. You don't immediately reward him for that.
They are immediately, though, giving up most of their centrifuges. Isn't that something?
It is something, but again, when I think about the ramifications down the road, I'm going to need more than that, I guess, from just one person sitting here that could have a vote on this at some point.
You mentioned this long administrative chain that goes into effect if we are not satisfied that they're complying. Does the end result of the U.S. controlling that final snapback satisfy you?
Having open and transparent inspections, I would prefer that it be immediate and very responsive and any time. You know, I'm not sure that language is in there to that respect. I think there's a long process that plays out. I know the UN is involved in that. I don't have a lot of confidence in the UN with some of these things.
If the U.S. and the international inspectors are not satisfied with how the inspections go, it triggers a process that goes to the UN, and the UN has to pass another resolution within 30 to 60 days, I believe. And if the U.S. isn't satisfied with that resolution, they veto it, and the sanctions immediately go back into place.
Yeah,
all of them.
Yeah, I guess the concern I have with that is 60 days is a long time. So if you're blatantly violating something and you get called out on it, and you have to wait 60 days until sanctions go into effect, I mean, I assume they're going to remedy that problem or try to fix it or mask that in that time period. To me, that leads to the cynicism of you know.
Enriching uranium to weapons grade, though, is a long, long process. It's mm-hmm. It's not subject to 60 days, really. Mm-hmm. So isn't that enough time?
In my view, it's not enough time, no.
The U.S. Embassy recently reopened in Cuba. Okay. What now? What should the U.S. be doing to try to effect change in that regime?
Well, I think Cuba, you know, if you look at, you know, the Farm Bureau, for instance, is very supportive of opening up relations with Cuba because of the, you know, the markets that provides for our commodities, corn, soybeans, other things. You know, Caterpillar, for instance, John Deere, lots of companies, State Farm, are supportive, the Chamber of Commerce, supportive of opening up trade and economic opportunities in Cuba. You know, obviously there's a long history with Cuba, but, you know, I think obviously the socialist, communist government that's been in place there clearly has not worked. I mean, it's almost like going back to the 1950s if you look at what's gone on in Cuba. So what's the best way to transition to possible democracy or economic freedom? I think trade does that and opening up normalization as it pertains to tourism, economic opportunity. I think in the long run, I think that's the best way to kind of transition their government and country, you know, to economic freedom and to a more democratic state. I think you've seen that in other places. Vietnam, I think, is a good example of that. You know, they were once we were at war in Vietnam, and now it's, you know, slowly transitioning to democracy. I think when you balance that out with Cuba, I think the upside of having normalization, having open trade for our agriculture, commodities, and other products, I think there's a bigger upside than there is a downside.
Is Hanoi really transitioning to democracy?
I think if you look at the amount of American companies that are going there and the amount of Americans that are going there for tourism, if you look at the amount of money that's being put in there now by lots of Western entities, I mean, it's changed dramatically in the last 10 years.
Yeah, that's different than their form of government, though. I mean, them proving that they are a stable government that is keeping the trains running on time and keeping a functioning economy that will attract business investment and tourism is one thing, but democracy is a different thing.
Yeah. Well, transitioning to the democracy that we have, which is obviously the gold standard in the world, what we have, I mean, lots of countries continue to try to do that, but having more economic freedom and letting people taste what, you know, that economic benefit that brings to them, I think that helps change governments.
You mentioned the Farm Bureau, the renewable fuel standard for how much ethanol needs to be in gasoline sold in the U.S. is a bone of contention. Where do you stand on that particular calculus?
Well, I do not support the current administration's emphasis on trying to reduce that. I think big oil, petroleum, you know, some members of Congress have tried to, you know, alter that or change that. I think it's worked well the way we've had it. I think it, first of all, it relates to jobs here in the 18th Congressional District. This is the 17th largest ag district in the country of 435. In my current Senate district, I have 4 ethanol plants in my district. I see the amount of jobs and opportunities it provides. But also, more importantly, it helps reduce our dependency on foreign oil. And I'd much rather have jobs and opportunity here and reduce our dependence on Saudi Arabia or Iran or any of the Gulf countries and have that. And I think it's been good for the environment.
There are 15 GOP presidential candidates. Surprisingly, not a record for presidential primary participation, but it is a lot. It's difficult even for those who pay deep and sustained attention to try to figure out who they're going to support. How do you propose to winnow the field in your own fashion or your own choice? And how do you suggest those less steeped in this subject do so?
I'm obviously just focused on my election on September 10th. I'm not interested in getting involved in a primary. I think the field we have, I think it's healthy for democracy to have broad perspective of people involved. We got a lot of smart, bright people that are interested in running, have good ideas. And I think the talent is tremendous. I mean, you know, you have governors, you have senators, you have people from the private sector. I mean, I think it's very healthy for democracy to have a primary, and we're going to have that. From my perspective, we need to find someone that's going to beat Hillary Clinton in the presidential race. That's what I'm looking at. Who's going to be the best person to do that moving forward? I think it's important to look at accomplishments of people and what they've done. You know.
So does it need to be a centrist Republican, or does it need to be a true conservative? Who's going to appeal more to the broader electorate?
Well, listen, after what we've had for the last 6.5 years with the Obama administration, I think we need to the pendulum has to swing back to a more conservative president. I mean, if you look at everything that's been put forth, I mean, I think we got to recalibrate in this country. And I think we have a lot of strong conservatives that are going to be running.
Darren LaHood is running as a Republican for Congress. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie. Great to be with you and your listeners.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.